Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Gates, How Erdic Makes the Difference. We are on Season 2, Episode 15, and we're going to be speaking with Dr. Robert Mosier. He is the Senior Research Civil Engineer with the Geotechnical and Structures Lab, otherwise known as GSL. We're going to be talking about engineering solutions through advanced materials. Good morning, Dr. Mosier.
Morning. How you doing, Annette?
I'm doing great this morning. So happy to have you here.
Well, thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. So, what is your role at Erdic?
So, I've been with Erdic almost 12 years now. And in my current role, I sit as a senior research civil engineer, but actually in a unique position I can tell you a little bit about, as a long string of words, called a senior scientific technical manager. And so, it's a really fun position because I get to do all the cool technical work and look across our laboratories, across our programs. And so what I like to tell people about what my role is I do strategic initiatives, program development, and partnerships. And that gets into the in-the-weeds technical content of our programs, the big things that our leadership, our Army, the Corps of Engineers is where we're going in the future and how do we address national priorities. And then how do we bring in partners, whether they're universities, local businesses, small businesses, industry partners, to try to complement the things that we do within Erdic to provide really the best solutions that we can for the Corps and the nation.
So that's a pretty big role.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We always have plenty to do. There's never downtime in the world. There's always things going on, and particularly in my area, you know, Erdic does so many different things in different technology fields. I primarily focus, as the title of this is, on advanced materials, but that also cuts across manufacturing and structural applications and things like infrastructure. And so I think that's one of the neatest things is everything's made out of a material. And
right.
So you get to work on all different kinds of stuff, whether it's biological, environmental applications or infrastructure or all kinds of things.
Sounds great. Sounds great. So here we go. Tell me about yourself and your background and what steps did you take to get to where you are? And what is your relationship with the community?
Okay. So like I said, I've been here about 12 years working at Erdic, starting as a research civil engineer, moving to senior and research civil engineer, and now in this SSTM long acronym role.
That is what the government is about.
Yeah, it's acronyms. If that's anything you'll learn, it's a lot of acronyms. And so I'm not originally from Vicksburg. We live here in Vicksburg, and I'm actually from South Florida. And so I grew up on the coast and went fishing every day. Lived just down the street from the beach. And so we lived there until I was in high school. And then at some point, due to some family illnesses, we actually moved to Georgia into a little colder climate up in the mountains. And so I finished out high school there. Started working actually to make some extra money as a carpenter when we were in high school, working on doing building renovations and things like that. And I had a really good mentor when I lived there. And so he, kind of my boss slash mentor, he said, you know, you're pretty sharp. You don't need to just be cutting 2x4s the rest of your life. And so he said, you know, you're here in Georgia, and we've got good engineering schools at Georgia Tech. He goes, I want to support you to go, you know, go down there and get engaged in engineering. And so while I was working with him as a carpenter, I went to junior college and took some base coursework, kind of like, you know, kids here go to Heinz or something. Finished that up, and then I went to Georgia Tech in Atlanta, got my bachelor's degree. And then at that point, the job market was not so hot. And so I stayed for a master's degree and actually looked at going to other engineering universities for my doctoral degree. But I was working with a really good group of people. That's something I value a lot is working with nice people that value you and the work that you do.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Yeah, certainly. And so I ended up staying there with a good team of folks and completed my PhD. And that actually afforded good opportunities to connect here at Erdic. And so, you know, as you go through school from, you know, high school and into college, there's a lot of opportunities for scholarships and fellowships and things like that. And one of the really neat programs that I got connected to, we've actually got quite a few employees here at Erdic and also over at the district through what's called the SMART program. That's another acronym. I think it's this scholarship for... mathematics and research for transformation or something like that.
You know, that sounds right, so we're going to go with that.
I think I'm a little off, but got into that program, and it supports your studies in school. It provides internships at laboratories or facilities within the government that are aligned with your interests, and then it provides a career path after you're done. And so that actually connected me here to ERDC in Vicksburg, was through that program. And so most of the research I was doing there at school was related to infrastructure materials at the time. I did work in my master's degree on things related to concrete durability, you know, looking at old structures, bridges, and airfields, and some deterioration mechanisms, how we extend the life of those projects. And then for my PhD, we worked on corrosion-resistant steels for bridge applications. And so as part of that fellowship program, I got connected here with ERDC and the Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory, because really across the whole federal government, the organization here, starting as the Waterways Experiment Station and now today as ERDC, has really led the world in that field of infrastructure materials. And so, you know, it's kind of cool to me to be connected to the place like you read about in the textbooks and everything,
right,
that did a lot of the historical work in my field. So finished school, came over here. Like I said, we live here in Vicksburg. Actually met my wife here. She's a technical director now in the environmental laboratory, one of the other ERDC laboratories. We probably have out of everybody I know, probably the nerdiest meeting story, because we actually met using the scanning electron microscope at ERDC.
So you're telling me something I did not know. That's great.
And so we met there. We've got a little son now. He goes to the St. Francis here right up the street. So we love it here. It's great.
That's great. That's fantastic. Yeah. And you were talking about the smart opportunities. We had Tracy Gordon on here talking about those types of opportunities. So it's great to hear how it all comes to play and how everybody comes here.
Yeah,
comes back.
It's so cool. You know, you make, I guess I realized in hindsight, I guess everybody does this as they grow up, but there's these little decisions, you know, you make along the way, mm-hmm, and kind of how they steer you in different directions. And luckily it seems to have worked out pretty well, but I think those scholarship opportunities, STEM opportunities, they're really valuable. Whether it's just a scholarship in school or an opportunity that leads to a job, you know, you can't get them if you don't apply for them, but if you try, there's a plethora of opportunities out there for sure.
That's exactly right. So I understand that blast and weapons effects on structures and geomaterials are an important research area at ERDC. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I guess I can explain what we can talk about on the radio, because there's definitely a lot of things we can't in that space. But
right.
So ERDC is one of the key R&D organizations in the Department of Defense. And so there's what we call science and technology laboratories. There's four of those in the Department of Defense. So ERDC is one of them, the Army Research Lab, the Air Force Research Lab, and the Naval Research Lab. And then within the Army, there's a whole bunch of other organizations that do research and development, whether it's on vehicles and tanks or missiles or communication systems. Kind of the different things that the soldier would use in the theater. And so one of the things that the department is really good about is they like to identify across all the mission sets that the Department of Defense would ever possibly encounter, right, in peacetime and in war, what are the core competencies that each one of those agencies brings to the fight. And so ERDC has 7 core competencies that are identified by the Department of the Army and Department of Defense. And one of those competencies is the one you asked about.
Right.
Blast effects. I got to look at it here to make sure I remember it, because it's another long string of words. Blast and weapons effects on structures and geomaterials.
Okay. Right?
And so that's one of the unique things that we do, really, as the R&D organization that leads all things in infrastructure and force protection. And so there's a lot of opportunities there for materials that we work in. So any kind of, you know, advanced material, lightweight material, things that our soldiers are going to use to protect themselves and enhance survivability in contested environments. And so when I think of, you know, what do we do in blast and weapons effects, it kind of spans the gamut from the soldier on the front lines that needs to harden very rapidly. So you think of, you know, lightweight systems that can rapidly be deployed, almost like you'd think of popping out a tent, right? But it doesn't have fabric on it. It's got things that protect them.
Right.
So things like that, up to, you know, lots and lots of steel and concrete and big structures to protect from big things, right? And we know that there's probably more of that in the news than we've had since the Cold War here lately. And so it really spans the gamut on how our soldiers are going to protect themselves, protect critical facilities and infrastructure. But the other part that's unique about that, that you know, I think the nation, many agencies outside of the Army as well rely on us, is we have an innate understanding of how you know, weapons and things interact with materials as well. And so we kind of focus on both sides of the coin. But I guess that's a, you know, summary of what we do there and what, okay, what's unique about ERDC's mission in that, that core competency.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
Patriot Motorsports is proud to announce the Simply the Brave program, now available from Skag Power Equipment. This program offers pricing discounts of 15% off the manufacturer's suggested retail price on Skag lawnmowers and mower accessories, and is available to current and retired fire, police, and EMT personnel, as well as active duty military and military veterans. Visit Patriot Motorsports today to learn more about the Simply the Brave program and Skag's incredible lineup of lawnmowers and debris management equipment. Terms and conditions apply. Financing available with approved credit. See Patriot Motorsports, Highway 61 North for details.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7. So if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Mosier. He is the Senior Research Civil Engineer with the Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory, otherwise known as GSL. And we're talking about engineering solutions through advanced materials. So what are a few of the advanced materials and manufacturing technologies ERDC is using, and why are they important?
Okay. I could probably talk about that all day.
Okay. You know, maybe half a day. Yeah. Let's just go with half a day.
You know, I guess when I think of what are we doing in advanced materials, and I'll probably separate materials and manufacturing.
Okay.
You know, I really see three big thrust areas that we're working on in advanced material technology. So one of them, and it goes back to the previous question, is on improved materials, lightweight systems, things for what we call force protection applications. So that's explosive events, it's mortars, it's ballistic threats, but any kind of dynamic threat that would come about and we would have to be resistant to and provide protection from. And so, you know, everything from very advanced types of concretes that we would use in structures to lightweight metals to composites, all kinds of materials that we would use to improve the level of protection. One of the unique things there is you don't do a lot of typical types of testing like you would maybe learn in school or a typical laboratory would do to understand those kinds of loads on materials and structures. And so there's a big emphasis there on what we call dynamic types of experiments. So things that maybe we can do in the laboratory that would simulate when a, you know, a mortar goes off at a forward operating base, right? Mm-hmm. And so unique types of experiments. And then one of the things that we really try to integrate into those programs is computational models, right?
Right.
It's expensive to run those experiments. It's dangerous, right? And so anything that we can do in a computer with a model that can kind of allow us to do virtually the types of experiments that, that sort of help us map out the space and fill knowledge gaps, we try to do in that as well. So a big emphasis on force protection technologies in different materials. The other area, a military-centric area, is what we call force projection-related applications. And so that's, you know, I think very tangible to the public because that's just like transportation, right?
Right, right.
How do I get from the, you know, the installation, the base here in the U.S. to the port and, you know, across the sea to deploy and maneuver wherever we need to go? And so a big emphasis there on things like rapid repair, right, particularly in contested environments, right? We know things are going to be damaged mm-hmm. during operation. So do we need to have new types of polymers or rapid setting concretes and things? We can go in and repair that infrastructure. A lot of the things that we talk about there are, I think they're really analogous to like natural disasters almost. And so how would we go in and repair infrastructure? Or oftentimes when we think of how we're going to use infrastructure, we may even have to upgrade its capacity to support a military operation.
Right.
So you go into a a small port in a developing country, they may not be able to handle the big ships and heavy loads and things that we're going to put on those structures. And so how do we go in and rapidly retrofit those? Another big component of that is systems that allow us to maneuver. And so there's a big emphasis on things like rapid bridging, rapid port construction, rapid airfield construction. And a lot of that comes into new material technologies, lightweighting of systems, modularity of systems, so that you can rapidly assemble them and disassemble them. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things in that space. And then the third area where there's, I would say, probably the biggest growth in our portfolio in materials is getting back to infrastructure. And that cuts across civil applications. Like I think a lot of the public thinks of when they think of the Corps of Engineers is, you know, dams and levees and hydropower projects, right? But also the infrastructure that's on our installations, on our bases, right, around the world. And so, you know, they're like cities. They have buildings, they have airfields and roads and bridges and rail systems and ports. And so there's critical infrastructure on those as well. And they suffer a lot of the same challenges across civil and military, right? We have aging issues. We can't afford to replace everything. We're always challenged with aging infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so between the drivers that we have on, really modernization of our infrastructure for the future, and then also things like sustainability and resilience, there's really a renewed emphasis on reinvesting and modernizing our infrastructure, civil and military. And a lot of that's going to be done with advanced materials, right? So how do I take a dam that's already 80 years old, it was originally designed to last for 40 years, and I got to make it last 150 years. How are we going to do that?
A little bit of a difference.
Yeah, so we got to retrofit those with, you know, composites to seal up joints, and maybe we're going to do repairs with some type of a very durable concrete to mitigate freeze-thaw damage or something. But
right.
A lot of advanced material solutions for infrastructure.
Okay.
One of the other unique things that has really grown in our portfolio beyond just the materials that we study, and I would say this is over the last 5 years, is really the advent of what in the Department of Defense today we typically refer to as advanced manufacturing technology, mm-hmm. right? And so in the past, if you thought of steel or concrete or composites, right, we're largely leaning on kind of historical manufacturing processes from industry. Mm-hmm. We may talk a little bit about things like additive manufacturing or 3D printing, but there's really, over the last few years, been like a revolution in manufacturing technology, and it's opening up windows to make materials, make things the way we never have before. And so that's another growing area in our portfolio at ERDC and across the entire Department of Defense. Pretty much every federal agency you can think of, especially Department of Defense, Department of Energy, Department of Commerce, they're looking at ways that we can use advanced manufacturing technologies to kind of revolutionize, almost like the second industrial revolution for how we manufacture everything using new technology. And so within ERDC, we've got, I really see it as four main lanes that we work in advanced manufacturing. So the first, and you know, y'all may have seen press releases and things, it's in like Popular Science and magazines on things we do in additive construction, right? And so we're moving beyond, you know, maybe 3D printing with some plastic, a little cool object, you know, that sits on your desk. We're building buildings with additive construction out of concrete and foam polymers, right? So something that's been developed for military applications, for things like contingency construction. Now it's spun off for civilian applications. There's a bunch of companies doing this. They're building residential houses.
I've seen videos, and it's just mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's really cool. And so that's one of the areas that we really lead is bringing advanced materials and manufacturing into the construction world. That's, you know, that's an ERDC niche for sure.
And again, everyone that sits in the seat that you do is just how everybody's slowly starting to understand how ERDC not just makes a difference, makes the difference. So that's really important work that you do there.
One of the other areas that I think is really, really interesting and unique is on, this is mainly led out of the environmental laboratory at ERDC, is as we develop these new manufacturing technologies, you think about in the past, you know, organizations like OSHA and other kinds of health and safety organizations, they've got a pretty tight control over safety, like on the factory floor and historical manufacturing processes. a lot of these new things, they use blown powders and they use lasers and you have people interacting with them. And so there's potential concerns to the operators of that equipment. There's right. potential concerns for like waste and things going into the environment. And so we're also looking at potential environmental impacts of things like advanced manufacturing and what we can do to help there. In my laboratory, a big emphasis is on advanced materials, right? And so maybe we're not interested as much in the manufacturing process itself, but it's really putting some more tools in the toolbox for us to do things in ways we never have before. So we can make a material that's some kind of a composite of ceramic particles that give us really high wear resistance or hardness with some metal that's good for structural applications, right? Mm-hmm. And we can manufacture those together. We could never do that before.
Right.
And so we're interested in those kinds of things. And then, you know, the fourth area, which is growing rapidly, and I think is kind of a unique hidden little jewel here in Vicksburg a lot of people don't know about, is within the ERDC organization, actually sits in the Information Technology Laboratory. We run the High Performance, this is another acronym, the HPCMP, which is the High Performance Computing Modernization Program for the entire Department of Defense, is run here out of Vicksburg.
Right.
So we've got a big supercomputing center there. And that's historically been used for everything from like weather modeling to designing of airplanes to modeling of floods and things like that. Mm-hmm. As manufacturing technology has pushed forward, we're increasingly looking at ways that we can use computational models and supercomputers to support manufacturing, right? So instead of me having to make 1,000 widgets and test 1,000 of them, I'm going to model 500,000 of them, and mm-hmm. I'm going to optimize them all on the computer and then come out with the most optimal part that I send to the factory floor to manufacture. And so those are some of the other things we're trying to do, you know, here from Vicksburg, but really supporting the entire Department of Defense in manufacturing technology.
Again, mind blowing. So, you know, you were talking about the manufacturing. What is additive manufacturing?
Yeah. So, I think a lot of people are have wrapped their head around additive manufacturing. You know, I guess in the past people probably would have called it 3D printing or something.
And it's okay.
You know, a lot of people think this is a pretty new technology in the last few years. It's been around a long time for decades, really, for very niche applications. But I think as it moved forward for, it's kind of an interesting paradigm shift where a lot of things, they start in high-tech industries, like say in the aerospace industry or something like that, and then they make their way into your garage eventually, maybe 20 or 30 years later. I think a lot of our understanding of things like additive manufacturing has been sort of flipped. And so it's kind of the hobbyist and folks doing 3D printing with plastics that have started a lot of interest in this field. And then it's just exploded, right? So Right. Now we're printing concrete. We're printing all different kinds of metals. We're printing composites. There's companies printing ceramics. And so this is really different than how you conventionally manufacture stuff. You know, if you think about the old-fashioned way of manufacturing, let's say we're talking about metals, you know, maybe we build a mold, you know, we heat up metal into a liquid and we pour it like concrete into right. the mold and we get a part.
Right.
Right. Or the way that we do a lot of things today is we get a large metal object, you know, cast in a factory, and we take it to the machine shop and we basically carve away the material. We call that subtractive manufacturing, the inverse of additive manufacturing. And so we subtract away the material we want to get the component you want.
Okay.
And so what additive is kind of the inverse of that. We're going to take the little building blocks, like the smallest Legos you can think of, and we're just going to add them together mm-hmm. And build up a 3D object.
Okay.
And so there's a multitude of different processes to do that. But I think the coolest part about it is it's getting into real applications. They're building replacement parts to go into airplanes, into spacecraft. We're building, this is some of the stuff I'm the most excited about is we're building infrastructure parts. So we're, you know, out on one of our dams, there may be a big metal gear from the early 1900s out of cast iron or something. We don't have the molds for that. We don't have the drawings, anything. And when that thing breaks, it takes a long time for us to fix it.
Right.
And so now, I mean, we're 3D printing. We're working right now with an industry partner to 3D print a 10-foot metal gear. to go on to a dam project. So there's all kinds of new opportunities in additive manufacturing.
And I know technology is just expanding as we breathe here. So I just can only imagine 10 years from now what mm-hmm. where we'll be and how fast and you know things will be going.
Yeah,
it's just mind blowing.
I think in our research, you're kind of in it, right? So you're right. In it and you're looking at it every day, and it can seem somewhat gradual,
right?
In the progression of it, because it's right in front of you. But I've gone back every once in a while. I'll try to go back and look through my files and see, well, what were we doing maybe 2 or 3 years ago? What were we doing 5 years ago or 10 years ago? And it's kind of shocking how fast some of these things happen, even though they may seem gradual.
And it's supposed to make jobs easier, but then, you're like, wow. And, then you just go on to the next thing and go, here we go. Mm-hmm. Here we go.
Yep.
So if you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Dr. Robert Mosier. He is a senior research civil engineer with the Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory, otherwise known as GSL. And we're talking about engineering solutions through advanced materials. Okay, let's now discuss sustainability in military installations and infrastructure. And what are the common drivers?
Okay, so this is a big thing in our portfolio right now.
Okay.
And so sustainability and resilience are key drivers. And even though the question, Annette's related to installations, I think it crosses over to civil. Really anything that has to do with infrastructure and facilities has drivers in that space. And so, from a sustainability perspective, we're trying to minimize the waste of materials, minimize the use of energy, anything that we can do to make our infrastructure projects, our facilities more sustainable. And so on a military installation, what does that get you? Well, so sustainability is, I feel from a mission perspective, and in the DoD, we're all about mission, right?
Right.
So we get these different drivers, but it's all about accomplishing the mission. And so if we can do things more sustainably, that generally means we're using more local materials. We're using lower energy. That means less fuel and things like that. So if I'm either on an installation or if I'm in a forward position in the South Pacific on a little installation, right, think of the logistics that have to go behind resupply and doing all the things to sustain, that installation or that small forward operating base. And so the goals that we have, let's say, in our civilian applications of sustainability, where we're trying to do, greener and cleaner things for the environment, they strongly align typically with what we want to do to accomplish the mission, mm-hmm. because we don't want to use as much fuel, we don't want to use as much energy, we don't want to have to carry everything with us from the United States to wherever we go in the world, so we want to use things that are local and indigenous. So there's big drivers there in sustainability. A lot of that from a DoD perspective, we see it's kind of, they're kind of holding hands with resilience. So you'll see those buzzwords kind of mentioned together a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so resilience is really thinking about how are we going to maintain our mission, accomplish our mission under any kind of adversity, right? So if whether that's nature or whether that's one of our adversaries, when they knock us down, we want to be able to get back up quickly,
right,
and recover and operate. And so increasingly we're thinking about things like, extreme weather events and the current administration has a lot of drivers in things like climate change that they're pushing as well. So how do we integrate that, again, from a mission objective perspective? If we're going to have extreme weather, if we're going to have other kinds of events, compound hazards is a big part of that. So what if we've seen examples of that, right, even during COVID, is mm-hmm. what if we get hit by a hurricane during a pandemic? How do we operate? So you
right.
can think about something like that in a war zone. How would that affect operations?
Right.
And so resilience plays a big role in that as well. And so when we talk about those, what are the technology thrust areas? It's materials. It's clean technology, low energy, low emissions, things like concrete and steel. Asphalt is a big focus area. But it's also on energy. Right. And so energy systems that are running our buildings, our facilities and infrastructure, and that includes building envelopes, HVAC systems, all the things that operate those on our installations as well. And that's another area where there's, I think, really strong alignment between, energy efficiency. And we've been doing that for a long time in what we call our operational energy programs. But again, it's about mission effectiveness. And mm-hmm. so we're not doing that because we want to reduce our energy footprint necessarily. We want to not have to rely on the community around the installation
right.
during some type of a contested environment. So we want to be, you know, energy independent, and the easiest way to become more energy independent is to reduce your energy requirement.
Right? Makes sense.
Reduce your burden. So a lot of things there on installations, and I think a lot of crossover to civil works applications as well. So a lot of emphasis there in materials.
Okay. So how is concrete critical to civil and military missions?
So if anybody knows me, they know I could talk about concrete all day, too. And I think a lot of people think concrete's that, you know, the gray stuff that's all around us. And
that you can pour, you know, anytime you want.
That you can get it wherever you want.
Right, right.
I think concrete is a fascinating material because it's the most used material in the world behind water. Right, it's available wherever you go. We make cement and concrete wherever you go in the world, from the Arctic to little islands in the Pacific we make concrete on, to underground, all kinds of places. But it's one of the most poorly understood materials out there, right, and highly variable. And so we look at, you know, what do we use in concrete? And I think a lot of times, just like anything in infrastructure, I think oftentimes maybe we don't appreciate how much we utilize that on a daily basis. So,
right.
Like, you know, this morning we woke up and got out of bed and I put my feet down on a concrete floor. We got in the car and we drove over bridges and roads and things
right.
to get here. Concrete is everywhere. And so I think the current stat is for every person in the world, we use about 1 cubic yard of concrete a year for our entire life.
Okay.
So, you know, there's like a small parking slab or a little building kind of dedicated to your existence built out of concrete.
Okay.
And so, you know, whether it's bridges or buildings, paving slabs, residential structures, wherever, we're using concrete. The main component of that is cement, of course, and that's produced around the world. And we use it on civil and military applications. And so it's a cool quote from actually a think tank at West Point. They went back and looked at previous conflicts, whether it's, you know, the fights in the Middle East or back to the Cold War and infrastructure we built there. And they say concrete is the least sexy but most effective material on the entire battlefield. Because when you look at all of the critical things that we do, most of them are enabled by concrete, whether it's
right.
airfields, whether it's perimeter security, whether it's hardened structures, it's ports. A lot of the things that we interact with ERDC are built out of concrete. Then, of course, here in our, you know, domestic infrastructure and the civil mission, most of those are made out of concrete.
Wow. Yeah, you probably could talk about concrete all day.
Yeah.
So what are some of the most prevalent deterioration mechanisms?
So in infrastructure, different classes of materials, whether it's concrete or steel, we have a lot of old projects even built out of timber and things in the Corps of Engineers. I think it's fascinating. We've got projects built in the early 1800s that still are functioning, made out of concrete and timber. We have 400 bridges in the Corps of Engineers. Those are typically bridges going across our projects, like
right.
across a dam or a river system. We have, I think our oldest bridge is 145 years old.
Okay.
Right, so you got a lot of old projects out there, right? We can't afford to replace all of them. So one of the folks at the Vicksburg District could tell you this a lot better than I could, but you look at, say, one of our big lock and dam projects on the Mississippi or the Ohio or the Arkansas River, those projects to rebuild they're billions of dollars, right? And so we've got...
B.
Yeah.
That was a B, everyone.
And so there's, I think if you look across that inventory in the Corps, just on the civil side...
Mm-hmm.
I think we have 700 or so dams, about 300 lock chambers, a few hundred hydropower facilities. You know, so you think about I think if you look at present day replacement value, it's probably on the order of trillions in infrastructure projects, which we're trying to maintain with billions of dollars, single billions of dollars in funding. And so we have this existing inventory of aging infrastructure that we got to make last longer.
Right.
And it crosses over to the civil side, the military side as well. And so I think a lot of people, when they think of who are the infrastructure agencies in the federal government, well, they probably do think of the Corps and dams and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
We think of like the Department of Transportation, right? Federal Highway Administration, things like that. The most infrastructure projects in the entire federal government are in the DOD, and the Army outweighs that by far. So we've got 800 bases around the world. I think the current stats are around 580,000 buildings. And wow. Then on those installations, there's about 100, 150,000 other kinds of assets, like right. like bridges and railheads, ports, things like that. So there's a bunch of infrastructure out there. And on the military side, right, that's infrastructure. It lives in the Arctic. It lives in corrosive environments in the South Pacific, in the Middle East. And we got to maintain that, too. And so that's a, I think that's actually a pretty cool part of our job is getting to assess those structures. Because like I said, we can't afford to replace them with things new. And so we're constantly getting reached back to figure out, almost like CSI, like what's going on in this airfield? Why is right. this crack happening in this steel gate structure? And so we'll get to go out and see those projects. We've got folks right now deployed, you know, all over the world looking at projects, supporting how they're going to modernize them, do repairs and things. And so it's you know, I guess the things you would typically think of as repair we see all the time, right? Things like corrosion, rust on our projects.
Which is going to happen.
Yeah, it's just a natural process.
Right.
Particularly if you're under-resourced in maintenance, you're going to have deterioration, right?
Right.
So we see typical things like that. A lot of issues with concrete structures. Like I said, there's a lot of concrete out there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those are actually because we built concrete structures before we knew a lot about how to make them durable.
Right. Right? Just like this needs to go up now.
Yeah. So right. in the big infrastructure boom here in the U.S., just as an example, a lot of those projects built before the about the late 1940s, early 50s. We used concrete that wasn't freeze-thaw resistant. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to deal with that in Mississippi, luckily. And that makes me happy coming from Florida. But we've got projects up the Mississippi River, up the Ohio River, out the Missouri River that are, they're falling apart due to natural freeze-thaw processes, right? And we can't fault the designers for that. They didn't even know this, right? They had to build these projects to serve the needs of the nation. And we're dealing with some of that today. How do we extend the life of those projects? So, you know, there's the typical types of deterioration you might see, like corrosion and freeze-thaw. But there's all kinds of weird stuff out there, too, because we have a lot of unique projects that live in unique places.
What's a weird thing?
So we finished a project. This is on the... Actually, a lot of them are in the South. I think so. Like, I guess
the common denominator
is weird things. we've done some analysis on some projects on the coast of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And some of this is actually in connection with things I did in grad school too. But we, you know, take concrete cores out of those projects and look at them, and there's weird little bug holes. They almost look like they're being eaten away. And so we actually found this is biological deterioration. And so you get to regions of the country where rather than like, you know, here in Mississippi, we use a lot of gravels and things mm-hmm. like siliceous, you know, silica-based rocks and gravels and whatnot. You get to coastal areas, they use a lot of things that are from like reef formations. So a lot of them are almost like limestone, coral kind of formations.
Will they use sand?
They'll use sand, right. And then they'll use a lot of their rock is not like a high quality, like a granite or something mm-hmm. we make it inland. They'll use something from like a limestone formation that historically, you know, in geologic time was probably coral beds.
Right.
And so what we actually found, you look at those things in the microscope and you see these little deposits in there where the concrete's being eaten. And it took a while. We actually had to engage some biologists and found that it was the same type of sponges that were eating coral reefs in the Caribbean were migrating up the coast because of warming water, and they were eating concrete. And so we had nice, beautiful-looking concrete, but then when you looked underwater, it'd have these little growths of sponges, and those sponges would basically be, like, drilling into the concrete, eating limestone. It was kind of wild.
That is very wild.
Things like that. There's other... I grew up in Florida. There's a lot of weird stuff that happens in Florida. And we actually just finished a project with the Jacksonville District recently. Another thing related to limestone, but a totally different mechanism. Mm-hmm. And so they asked us, why is my concrete just dissolving? So they built these projects. These are on the Kissimmee River Basin. So mm-hmm. there's a series of, you know, here in Vicksburg, we're used to big rivers.
Right.
And big structures. They have these cute little lock structures that are very, they're very tiny, like, and they basically pass pontoon boats and bass boats up and down the river for people going fishing.
Okay.
And but basically control the flood water and stuff on the Kissimmee River Basin. They build these projects. They're going out and doing periodic inspections, and they're asking us, why is our concrete just dissolving into the water? So it's only maybe 10 years old, and it's lost about 2 to 3 inches of concrete just dissolving. And so we had to go in. We actually engaged from the environmental lab here at ERDC, some water quality folks. They did some analysis, and actually the specific type of concrete they were using used some rock, which was from another area of Florida. And the same issues you probably see on the news where they have these sinkholes mm-hmm. and whatnot in Florida.
Right.
So they got a really weird water quality challenge there where the materials they're using to make their concrete were actually dissolving just because of the chemistry in the water.
Like, and coming from somewhere else?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
And so we actually had to map out that region, and it's actually guiding what they're doing now on projects. So they make their material selections for their projects based on where they are in the state and the composition of the water.
Okay.
And it may be more expensive at the outset because they got to ship in materials that are more durable from a further distance. But over the life cycle of those projects, it's actually cheaper because the material's durable, right? It's going to last a long time. You're not going to have to do repairs.
Okay. Kind of the similar way of at Eagle Lake. It's where I live. It's better to use the same dirt up there to do projects than bring it in from somewhere else.
Right.
That's what we've been told. And it's kind of very important, the structure of the dirt.
I'm Annette Kirkland. Beyond the Gates continues in a moment. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
You know, nowadays it seems like nothing is built to last. Like phones, appliances, cars, computers. But the new Michelin Defender 2 tire is designed to outlast. With a quiet and comfortable ride, you'll have the confidence you need on the roads, whether they're wet or dry. So, goodbye to short-lived, and hello to something that lasts.
Abe's Tire and Automotive, Highway 61 North, gives you free balance and rotation for the life of your tires. Abe's Tire and Automotive.
Welcome back to Beyond the Gates. You're listening to News Talk 107.7.
If you're just tuning in, I am speaking with Dr. Robert Mosier. He is a senior research civil engineer with the Geotechnical and Structures Laboratory, otherwise known as GSL. And we're talking about engineering solutions through advanced materials. Okay. Can you tell us about some of the military engineering technologies being currently developed at ERDC?
Sure. So, you know, we talked a little bit about things like protection and advanced materials. There's a lot of other things going on in the military engineering space. And when we think about what is military engineering, it's another term that's, you know, probably generic to the public. But that really relates to, and I'm using quotes here on the radio, the engineer mission. And so, you know, when you look across the Army, you have different specializations in different, I mean, they're like tasks, right? Like I'm a plumber or I'm a welder or a school teacher. There's engineers, right? And mm-hmm. the engineers do military engineering things, which means they do breaching, they do bridging, they build stuff, they blow stuff up, they right. do all kinds of things. And so military engineering are what are the technologies, the approaches, the materials, anything that those engineers need to do to accomplish their mission. So a lot of that are some of the things I talked about earlier with protection technologies. You know, how do we rapidly build a shelter that has protection from whatever the local threats are? How do we rapidly breach an obstacle? How do we rapidly bridge over a river to move vehicles are in that mission space. But there's a lot of cool things that we're doing. You know, I would say to, and this is all, you know, open, unclassified, right? Because we're right. on the radio. But there's a lot of cool things moving forward in alignment with Army modernization. Something, you know, modernization is going on across the entire Department of Defense, but especially in the Army. And so when you look at how is the Army modernizing different things like vehicles and aircraft and whatnot, for those things to operate, they rely on engineers.
Right.
So I can have the best plane in the world, but if it doesn't have an expeditionary airfield to take off from and land to drop off cargo or pick up and move troops, it's pretty darn useless, right?
Pretty much.
I could have the best robotic tank, and if it can't figure out how to cross a river, well, most of the places we want to go have rivers.
Right.
and other kinds of obstacles. So how are they going to operate? And that's where they rely on us,
right?
In that military engineering mission. And so we're trying to look at what is the future of the things that the Army is going to have and how they're going to operate, and what are the engineers going to have to do to enable that. And so I think some of the coolest things there are, of course, the protection technologies and rapid power projection, whether it's, you know, bridges and airfields and things like that. But we're even relying on ERDC in the military engineering area to support vehicle development and aircraft development. And so the Army is making huge investments in what we call autonomy. And so you think about, you've got a limited number of soldiers, very dangerous environment. Can we do things with autonomous, like robotic systems that can go out and operate? They can do surveillance. They can send information back to safer areas so we know what we're going into. Mm-hmm. And so when the Army is developing those systems, they're saying, who understands the environment? Who across the Army knows about the operational environment? And that's what we do in the Corps of Engineers. And so how does this autonomous thing perceive a ditch, right? How does it perceive an obstacle? How does it plan to use roads and bridges and other things to maneuver from point A to point B? And so for even very advanced technologies like a robotic vehicle, we're working to enable those to operate as well, and all that's in the military engineering area.
Okay. Sounds great. Sounds great. So what are some of the partnerships with ERDC that allow coordination and collaboration across the industry?
Okay. So that's probably my favorite thing of my job, and somewhat the most challenging, not because it's hard or bureaucratic, but because there's so much going on. Mm-hmm. And you could spend all your time, I think, focused on partnerships and coordination, because it's fun, right? You get to work with fun people. You get to work with students and
right.
businesses that have really cool ideas. And how do we get them? The Army and the Department of Defense, as we've talked about with our acronym SOUP, we have a different speak. We almost have a whole different language. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it's fun to be kind of the translator to take, you know, all the cool things that we know are going on and the great ideas and the bright students and bring them into the fold to the benefit of the Corps of Engineers and the Army. So that's probably the funnest part of my job. And so across all the different areas, military and civil, you'll see a really strong network of partners. And those are a lot of those are partners here locally and in the state of Mississippi. So we've got big programs doing research and development and training students, doing STEM outreach at the big, you know, universities in Mississippi State, at University of Mississippi, Southern, Jackson State, Alcorn, you know, different types of outreach activities and joint research programs. You know, really developing a pipeline, a workforce of students that are trained in STEM fields, whether they come to work at ERDC or they go to work for anybody.
Right.
You know, we know that's for the good of our country. So a lot of academic interactions there, and then a lot of industry. So the industry folks are trying to build new manufacturing capabilities, new sensors, all of these things that can benefit the department as well. And so that's a lot of fun to me to spend time working with those folks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other thing we've really been trying to grow here locally is through an organization that's actually established downtown. You've probably seen some in the paper and things like ERDC Works.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a unique kind of third party, you think of it, outside of the gate organization to do community development, to develop small businesses, to train people how to work better with the government, because I'll tell
right.
you, even inside of the government, I don't know how everything works. If I was outside, it would probably be even worse. And so, you know, we're trying to develop capabilities to improve those kind of partnerships and community
right.
development. And then key to that is, like most things, is, you know, you can push as much as you want, but at some point you generally need money to do
always.
Things and develop,
always.
You know, develop real products. And so that's another thing I've been really excited about is not just making those connections, but developing, you know, formal partnerships and contract vehicles and ways that we can collaborate more formally and move money to do real work and develop real companies and new technologies.
And it can't work without partners.
Yeah,
it just really
definitely.
Can't. So, you know, I've been super excited to have you wrap up season two this year, or this season, excuse me, as we'll do with the show. But, you know, last season we had Dr. Pittman round off season one. So we have you here today wrapping up season two, and I'm super excited to have you do so. And so with that being said, what do you want listeners to remember from this valuable conversation?
Thanks, Annette, and thanks, everybody. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate this morning.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm not from Vicksburg, but I'm excited about what we're building here. You know, and I think I've talked to folks that I work with that have been here a long time, or folks that grew up in Vicksburg and worked at Waterways, now work at Erdic. And, you know, the ecosystem that's developing here, I think, is really exciting. And the way that we're trying to align that with strategic initiatives in Erdic and across the Corps of Engineers is really exciting. And I think one of the things when was General Spellman on?
He was on last August.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when he was on, he talked about something that was just new. It was just in its infancy. And we have really been trying to transform the way that we do research in the civilian space of our portfolio. And so he introduced some concepts on how we were trying to do that, how we're trying to get after, you know, what are the big, big long-term challenges facing our nation and infrastructure and environmental problems and natural disasters. And so I think it's exciting that just in the last few weeks, the things that we talked about, you know, months ago mm-hmm. are now coming to fruition. And so we're excited to see some new things coming out as we kind of work our way through the bureaucratic wickets of developing budgets.
There's always wickets.
Yeah, there's always wickets. And so we're seeing some of those programs cross the finish line. And so, you know, I think by next season, it's going to be really cool to see some of these new programs. I mean, we're talking about robots that go out and repair structures, or satellites that identify environmental blooms, contaminants in the environment, or, you know, ways that we can get, you know, weeks or months out of predicting floods in much better ways than we ever could before, ways that we can fight those and respond to them better than we ever could before. And so that's, you know, I think that's an exciting development to me.
Right.
Again, seeing that work its way through the process. And that'll be an exciting area in the future with a lot of partnership opportunities too. So
fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And thank you everyone for listening to Beyond the Gates. We are ending with season two with a great show, and we want everyone to have a great day. And thank you for listening to Beyond the Gates, how Erdic makes the difference.